Saudi Arabia, and we only have 30 seconds. U.S. just signing one massive arms deal after another with Saudi Arabia.
It's the weirdest part of the war on terror, which is that there's one country basically most identified with the 9/11 attacks and the ideology that drove it, and that happens to be the second closest ally of the United States in that region, which is Saudi Arabia. And they not only were responsible for lots of parts of al-Qaeda, but are funding in lots of different ways ISIS as well, and yet we continue to hug them while waging war in countries that have never had anything to do with attacks on our country.
Glenn Greenwald, we want to thank you for being with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. We will link to your pieces at The Intercept, among them New York Times editorial slams disgraceful CIA exploitation of Paris attacks, but submissive media role is key. Glenn Greenwald is speaking to us from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. That does it for our broadcast. We have a job opening. Democracy Now! Is hiring a director of development to lead our fundraising efforts. You can find out more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, I'm Alcoff, Robbie Karen, Steve Martinez. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeet Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's 4 o'clock p.m., 5 o'clock p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The Thursday evening news is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Clinton Street Stomp, an evening of unamplified performances by some of the region's root music acts, playing the third Saturday of each month, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, the November 21st features The Earnest Lovers, Squirrel Butter, Joe New with Brian Oberlin, The Hi-O Rebblers, and is hosted by country blues yodeler Zach Bryson. Again, that's the Clinton Street Stomp, Saturday, November 21st, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm. On the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. A $100 new or increased donation will become $200 to support the important work of KBOO. If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched one-to-one by a group of generous donors up to $10,000. Consider becoming a monthly sustaining member. This can be set up easily and securely online. Over 70% of KBOO's income is from you, our listeners, who take action to become KBOO members. Go to kboo.fm/support to have your donation matched today. Or mail your donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the United States House of Representatives passes a bill that discriminates against Syrian and Iraqi asylum seekers.
Local residents in the Portland area stand up against racism with rallies in Lentz and at Lewis and Clark College.
And Paris officials ban large protests at the upcoming climate talks, citing security concerns.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 19th, 2015. I'm Sarika Mehta.
And I'm Robert Barncor. The U.S. House of Representatives today passed a bill by overwhelming majority This bill puts huge restrictions on the entry of Syrian and Iraqi refugees into the United States. A coalition of civil rights and immigrant rights groups have come together in opposition to the bill. They say the bill unjustly discriminates based on national origin. The bill is called the American Security Against Foreign Enemies Act of 2015. This adds up to being called the SAFE Act for short. Although President Obama has said he will veto the bill, the House has passed the bill with a veto-proof majority. Only 2,000 Syrian refugees, nearly all of them women and children, have been accepted into the United States this year, and that represents about 0.02% of the more than 9 million refugees who've been displaced from Syria. We'll have a full report on this bill, including an interview with the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee later this hour at 5:45.
Residents of Southeast Portland are holding a rally this Sunday to say no to the Ku Klux Klan and racism. This comes after a series of recruitment flyers for the KKK appeared in the Portland area. KABU reporter Sam Bowman has more.
Oregon has a long history of racism and has been host to a number of white supremacist groups throughout its history. This includes the Klan, which during the 1920s enjoyed real political power in the state. However, these days the Klan presence was thought to have all but disappeared, with the Southern Poverty Law Center no longer listing the Klan as an active hate group in Oregon. But now, the past week has seen a number of incidents of KKK flyers being distributed in working-class white neighborhoods in the outer southeast Portland area.
There were KKK recruitment flyers in Vancouver, in Gresham, in Oregon City, West Lynn, Molalla, and Silverton. So we're talking about quite a lot of ground so far.
That's Choya Adkisson-Stevens, a co-founder of the group Surge PDX, which stands for Showing Up for Racial Justice, a local branch of the National Surge Group.
KKK organizing is just the tip of the iceberg. It's the most obvious or grotesque form of racism, and that it encourages people in a similar way to other far-right organizing. It encourages people to feel more free to speak in racially hateful ways and to excuse racially disparate policies that our communities are still occupying or still utilizing. And so what we're concerned about is both the possibility of racialized hate violence in our communities as you know, symbolized by the KKK, but also the ongoing violence that communities of color are suffering in our city and across our state.
Surge is holding a rally this Sunday at the Lentz Farmers Market, along with the group For White Accountability and Racial Dialogue, or FORWARD. These organizations work to organize white communities to work towards the goals of racial justice, together with groups such as Black Lives Matter and Don't Shoot Portland.
From my experience, white people are really looking for a structure and a way to become useful in the work for racial justice and liberation for all of us. And so Surge seeks to, and our sister group, FORWARD, seeks to fill that need for white people to come together and educate one another and create momentum in our own communities around dismantling white supremacy and creating that, contributing to that liberation that our people of color community members are also building for.
In addition to the flyers, there were reports of a KKK rally on Portland's Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard last Thursday, which turned out to be false, or at least exaggerated. In the wake of that scare, though, a number of law enforcement officials want to downplay the flyers. Oregon City Police spokeswoman Sergeant Cynthia Gates worries that media attention to the flyers will only give white supremacists a platform, and that it should be left up to police to, quote, make it go away. West Lynn PD spokesman Sergeant Dave Kempis went as far as to say that he doesn't see the flyers as a, quote, real issue, unless they continue appearing. Activists with the Black Lives Matter movement and its allies have rejected this attitude.
We have a long history of both overt racist organizing, such as KKK and neo-Nazi activity, and also of city and county policies and state laws that have created conditions under which people of color in our communities are experiencing very high levels of violence, of educational and housing and income disparities, of health disparities. And this is really the overarching condition under which Surge and other groups like us are doing our work, is recognizing that those are the current conditions. We're inviting people to join us for this rally, which will create an opportunity for everyone in our community, and especially for white people, to speak out against KKK and other organized racist hate groups, and to speak in support of communities that are truly safe for everyone, and especially for people of color.
The rally will be held at the Lentz Farmers Market site at Southeast 92nd Avenue and Foster Road in Portland's Lentz neighborhood, starting at 1:30 p.m. It will include music, speakers, time for attendees to share their experiences, and a moment of silence for Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old African-American boy killed by police in Cleveland a year ago. Following the rally, there will be carpools available to a Black Lives Matter vigil for Rice at Southeast 11th Avenue and Madison. For Cable Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman. We heard from Choya Adkisson-Stevens of the group Showing Up for Racial Justice, or SURGE.
And students at Lewis and Clark College here in Southwest Portland held a walkout and a protest after racist comments were posted on a social networking site in the area. The racist comments included direct threats against African Americans, with the commenter posting, quote, "I just want to hang you ignorant black people." But Portland police didn't feel there was a specific enough threat for them to actually investigate, and the police claimed that the social media threats were protected free speech. However, students at Lewis and Clark disagree. On Wednesday, they staged a walkout and a rally for Black Lives. The Black Student Union also drafted a list of demands for the university, which include active recruitment of faculty of color, more authors of color in the freshman core curriculum, and an increase in financial resources for students of color and low-income students. This list of demands includes a demand for specific timelines when the college intends to meet these goals. It was around this time last year that a similar series of messages were posted on the same social media app, known as Yik Yak, which tracks the location of the people who post comments but allows the comments to be posted anonymously. The incident last year included a string of racist comments along with a picture of a gun. And a year before that, in November of 2013, flyers advertising the school's annual Symposium on Race and Ethnic Studies were torn to shreds. Weeks later, racist graffiti was sprayed throughout the campus. Students have argued that the administrator's response was weak, and so they staged a sit-in protest against racism on campus.
A committee of the Oregon House of Representatives held a hearing this week on affordable housing needs in Oregon. The meeting was to assist in the drafting of a bill to be presented to the legislature in February. Here's a sampling of some of the testimony from the committee hearing.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, I'm Lynn McConnell from Neighbor Impact in Central Oregon. I'm here to talk to you about the housing climate in Central Oregon and how things have changed recently. I'm eager for you to meet Jessica, who's back in the back of the room, who can tell a story that is as amazing as she is. And so you'll hear a little bit of an on-the-ground perspective momentarily. I think it's not an understatement to say that we are facing a crisis in Central Oregon around housing generally and affordable housing in particular. Vacancy rate, as you may know, is around 1%. This means there are two or fewer units available in each of our small towns at any given time. Typically, we hear reports of 20-plus applications for each unit. Each application typically costs at least $40 per adult in the household. So a two-person household, you can imagine how much money is going out the door just to get in line. The average rent of available units is about $1,350. Most of those are freestanding three-plus bedroom homes, which are completely out of reach. Fair market rent, according to HUD in Central Oregon, is about $802. So there's a huge discrepancy between what we're able to pay, even when folks do qualify for assistance, and what is actually going on on the ground. A recent study indicated that in order to live in the U.S., people needed to make about $16 per hour to survive. $25. In Central Oregon, that's about $19 an hour. That was last spring, in order to be able to get into any rental unit around. So we, again, the wage question is at the forefront. I think that perhaps the best way to explain to you the situation that we're seeing on the front lines is to tell you just a couple of stories of calls that we've received recently. Last week, one of my staff members got a call from an 80-year-old woman who's living on Social Security and is unable to make her $700 a month rent. She had half of it, but was desperate for assistance. And we had to tell her, we can't help you. Another call that we received this spring was a family of five who owns a small business and has been completely self-sufficient, has never received benefits of any type until the father was diagnosed with brain cancer. With these small children in the house, they were forced to close their small business. They came to us for assistance, and we said, there's nothing we can do to help you. A woman with domestic violence in her past who has worked in the healthcare industry. She averages over 60 hours a week and has been stable in her job for several years. She transitioned. She has two small children, transitioned to a one bedroom and was sharing with her children to try to save some money. Her rent was increased from $740 to above $1,000 in a matter of months, and she became homeless. This is a middle class person in the healthcare industry, the type of people who typically would contribute, but because of the dramatic increases we've seen on the ground, she was staying with us in our shelter. There's an endless number of stories.
Chair Kinnegayer, members of the committee, Gwen Baldwin, here today representing Multifamily Northwest. Our members have approximately 165,000 units of rental housing all across Oregon, ranging from folks with one or two units to members of the over 18,000 units. Today, in many parts of Oregon, rental vacancies are 3% or less, and demand is pushing prices way up. We got to this place in large part because during the Great Recession, virtually no multifamily was developed. And at the same time, demand for rentals increased from displaced homeowners and Oregon's healthy, strong immigration. And the surge of short-term rentals, frankly, didn't help. Supply will catch up and the market will correct, but in the near term, the challenges for many renters are painfully real as they try to find rentals they can afford. We know this. We see this. Recent media attention has focused on a few instances where significant renter turnover occurred after buildings were sold or renovated using end-of-tenancy notices. As I stated earlier, these notices are rarely used and critical to remain for the well-being of our residents. However, we are willing to look at the dynamics around building sales and renovation and identify workable modifications in the short term. Multifamily Northwest appreciates being here today and looks forward to working with you in 2015 and beyond on the critical issue of housing affordability.
My name is Colini Fuzitoa. I'm a case manager for ERCO, Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, and I'm a culture-specific case manager. So I work specifically with Pacific Island community. But I'm here today to share their frustration. They're not only the Pacific Island community, but also other community from immigrant refugee community in the Portland area. What they have shared with me, their frustration is because now of the increased rent, there's a lot of people doubling up. They're doubling up with families, not because, you know, they want to build family bonding and family value. It's not that. It's for survival, because now families are not able to afford all this affordable housing. This is not affordable for them because, you know, their rent has increased 30-40% just within the last month, 2 months. The city of Portland did over at the Alberta neighborhood, you know, they did all this renovation and so forth. So the Pacific Island community moved out of there. So we moved to the east side. But now everywhere, the rent has increased. It is very important that we have stable housing because it's expensive. Not monetary-wise, but it's expensive, and our children is paying the price because our adjustment to the new environment, leaving our children missing school, poor grades, poor attendance. Next thing you know, what happened? Graduation time, our children are not there. We're having probably 20-25% graduating. It's because we don't have stability.
That was testimony from this week's committee hearing in Salem on the issue of affordable housing in the state of Oregon.
authorities in France have banned demonstrations at the upcoming climate talks in Paris. The French authorities cited security concerns as the reason for banning these protests. The Conference of the Parties, known as the COP15, which is a meeting of world leaders, will take place in Paris 2 weeks from now. The objective of the meeting is to create a comprehensive worldwide plan to address the issue of climate change. The director of Oil Change International's campaign spoke with KABU reporter Robin Ryan about the French decision to ban these protests at the talks.
Authorities have announced that demonstrations planned to take place during the COP21 need to be canceled due to security concerns. How much do you see this development changing the frame of dialogue at the event, and in what way?
I think it's obviously unfortunate, and our thoughts go out to everyone that's been affected by the attacks in Paris. They're tragic and terrible. And there have been people working on the march that was supposed to be held in Paris on the 29th for months. And it was going to be one of the largest climate marches perhaps ever. So it's obviously unfortunate that it's not moving forward. But on the more positive side of things, there are dozens upon dozens, if not hundreds, of mobilizations that are set to take place around the world on the weekend of the 29th of November. And so our hope, and I think the climate movement's hope, is that those mobilizations will be all the bigger to show solidarity to those in Paris dealing with the tragic events and still pushing forward for climate action. So our hope is that the mobilizations around the world can show that the movement is huge and massive and growing. And those of us who will be in Paris are able to raise our voices in other creative ways to ensure that decision makers and negotiators in the COP are able to know that we're not going anywhere, that the movement continues, and that they are in the spotlight and need to take robust action.
During the recent Democratic presidential debate, there was some discussion of instability in the Middle East and that it's due in part to climate change. Can you speak to the differences that the region faces as it compares to what folks know here stateside?
It was an important question during the debate, and there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not Senator Sanders answered it in the best way. What's clear is that climate change is a threat multiplier, and the impacts of climate change can make problems in various regions of the world all the more dangerous. So in the Middle East and in Syria in particular, they're grappling with a record-breaking drought that causes issues around famine and food scarcity and other challenges that can multiply the threats of existing conflict in the region that much further. Obviously, terrorism conflict is something that needs to be addressed head-on and needs to be addressed in a careful way. But what we know is that climate change makes that all the harder to deal with and all the harder to address. So when Senator Sanders said that climate change remains a top national security issue, that's, I think, what he was pointing towards. The fact that when you have vulnerable regions impacted by climate change, those vulnerabilities, those conflicts can become even worse. And that's a problem for all of us.
Can you share with our listeners whether or not information generated for your organization's Empty Promises report correlating G20 countries, $452 billion in subsidies to the fossil fuel industry, will that report enter the fray of discussion?
We hope so. We put out that report with another organization called the Overseas Development Institute, and we received hundreds of media hits from outlets around the world. And we were really pleased to see that because these numbers are shocking. $452 billion going directly from governments in the G20 nations to fossil fuel producers. This is a massive amount of money, basically making the problem worse, while these governments are obviously saying that they want to be tackling climate change. So we're hopeful that they saw that the report was being shared and reported on around the globe. We're hopeful that they're going to be, frankly, embarrassed by the results of the report and that they'll agree to take action moving forward to really bring that number down to zero.
I know you're planning to attend the conference. Are you at liberty to discuss how you see your role in that environment at that time?
I will be participating a combination of outside of the negotiation center itself as well as inside. And on the outside, despite the events that took place in Paris, there's still going to be a lot of activity of organizations and individuals and activists coming together to plot strategy for the coming years. The climate movement won't be ending after Paris. The struggle will obviously be continuing. So there's a lot of meetings and events and other ways of sharing experiences and coming together as a movement to have dialogue. But then on the inside, in the negotiations themselves, we're all going to be making sure that governments are actually walking the talk. They've been saying a lot of good things. There's a lot of, I think, positive momentum from the negotiations heading into Paris. But we really want to make sure that at the end of the day in Paris, they're actually following through with those commitments and with the strong rhetoric that they've been conveying. So we'll be doing a combination of literally monitoring the negotiations, watching as the text is changed and edited and all of that to make sure that there aren't loopholes introduced, that there aren't backtracking or other ways that governments can avoid taking the action that we want to see them take, but also making sure that we're translating the UN speak to the public, because these can be very incomprehensible and inaccessible negotiations to an ordinary person who cares about climate change. And so what we're going to try to do is ensure that we are sort of translating that UN speak to the public so they understand what's going on through the media, through social media, through other avenues, to be sure that world leaders hear from the public and that the public can be informed and understand what's going on so that they can pressure world leaders to do better.
I've been talking with David Turnbull from Oil Change International. For more information, you can visit their website at priceofoil.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
This week, the social networking giant Facebook released new data showing a 2,000% increase in wiretapping of user accounts by law enforcement. Privacy experts say that this increase is massive and unexpected. In the first half of 2015, U.S. law enforcement agencies sent Facebook 201 wiretap requests for 279 users or accounts. For comparison, Google received only 18 wiretap requests in 2013 from federal officials and 12 in 2014. The spike in requests by law enforcement for access to Facebook accounts appears to go against the general trend of wiretaps in the U.S. According to official statistics released by the U.S. government, in comparison to 2013, wiretaps in 2014 decreased slightly. A spokesperson for Facebook refused to comment on the report, but the company did confirm that the number includes both Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Abed Ayoub, who is with the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee. And we'll do an in-depth look at the SAFE, S-A-F-E, Act, which has passed the House of Representatives with bipartisan support just today. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. And at 7, it'll be Ear to the Streets of Portland, featuring members of the Portfolio Project, which aims to help 11th and 12th grade minority students in Northwest communities to apply for college and for scholarships. Tomorrow's weather will be cold and cloudy, with a high of 48, a low of 35, which means watch for ice in shady and protected places. There will be a minimal chance of rain. Today in history, November 19th, marks the 70th anniversary of the beginning of the Nuremberg trials of Nazi war criminals in 1945. And in 1994, the Angolan government and the UNITA rebel group signed the Lusaka Protocol in Zambia, formally ending the 19-year-old Angolan civil war. The quote of the day is from the Spanish anarchist Buenaventura Durruti, who was killed by a sniper's bullet on this day in 1936. No government in the world fights fascism to the death. When the bourgeoisie seeks power slipping from its grasp, it has recourse to fascism in order to maintain itself.
It's 5:27, time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
Donnie Trump is for it. Barack Obama is too. as are Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton. It is the idea of finally ending a ridiculous tax loophole that was written by and for the richest, most pampered elites on Wall Street. An obscurely titled carried interest tax break allows billionaire hedge fund hucksters to have their massive incomes taxed at a much lower rate than the one teachers, Main Street businesses, carpenters, and other modest income people must pay. This privileged treatment of money shufflers over people who do constructive work in our society adds to America's widening chasm of inequality. It's so unfair and unpopular that even Trump and Bush see that it has to go. So it's bye-bye loophole, right? Just kidding. Trump can mouth all he wants, but no animal has such fury as a hedge funder whose special tax boondoggle is threatened. Trump had barely gotten the word unfair out of his puffy lips before the tax loophole profiteers deployed battalions of lobbyists, PR flacks, and front group operatives to defend their precious carried interest provision. Just one group, with the arcane name of Private Equity Growth Capital Council, rushed a dozen Gucci-clad lobbyists to Capitol Hill to, quote, inform lawmakers about the virtues of coddling Wall Street elites with tax favors. Of course, informing meant flashing their checkbooks at key members of Congress. After all, even the loudest blast of political talk is cheap, and it's the silent sound of a pen writing out a campaign check that makes Washington whirl keep spinning in favor of the rich. This is Jim Hightower saying, sure enough, Representative Paul Ryan, the new leader of the U.S. House, has assured the check writers that, the will of the people aside, he'll not allow any effort to repeal the hedge fund loophole to get out of committee. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
A new report titled Mend the Gap has been put out by the Oregon Health Equity Alliance. It comes to some worrisome conclusions about the distribution of health coverage here in the state of Oregon. KABU reporter Sam Bowman has more on this in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
The Affordable Care Act may have prompted more people to sign up for health insurance, but in Oregon, a new report says 383,000 residents remain uninsured. Some can't get coverage and others can't pay for it. The Oregon Health Equity Alliance is a coalition making 10 recommendations to state lawmakers to close the insurance gaps. Joseph Santos Lyons with the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, or APANO, says one of the largest gaps affects about 89,000 people who might look for coverage on the state health insurance exchange but can't afford it.
If you are the very lowest income levels for the exchange, right above Medicaid, you are twice as likely to go uninsured. The out-of-pocket costs and the premiums are just too high, and a high deductible of, say, $2,000 to $5,000. Folks just don't access care.
He says this group also includes 6,000 to 8,000 legal permanent residents of Oregon. Another 1,500 are from COFA nations under a treaty that allows some Pacific Islanders to live and work legally in the U.S. but bars them from receiving Medicaid. The coalition will back several bills in the next legislature to address the gaps. The report says lack of insurance falls disproportionately on people of color, with uninsured rates 2 and 3 times that of white Oregonians. Another large group without health coverage is children of undocumented immigrants. In terms of public health, Carla Castaneda with the Momentum Alliance thinks that doesn't make sense.
They attend school, they go to the parks and play, basically. Their health is what makes the community healthy, and we're not providing undocumented children health care. Like, Oregon values kids, but we're not valuing undocumented children.
The Mend the Gap report also highlights the struggles of rural women to seek reproductive health services, the barriers to getting coverage for transgender people, and the lack of affordable dental and vision insurance through the state. For KABU Evening News, in collaboration with the Oregon News Service, I'm Sam Bowman.
Dozens of local residents gathered at the Marriott Hotel last night in downtown Portland for a hearing about the Hanford Nuclear Facility, which sits upstream of Portland along the Columbia River in Hanford, Washington. Hanford administrators have requested a delay in the required cleanup of nuclear material on the site. Here's a sampling of the testimony at last night's hearing.
My name is Caradwyn Terrell. I teach at Concordia University here in Portland. This was years and years ago that these warnings were coming out and reports were written. DOE apparently changed the reports that were submitted to make things not look as bad as they were. And so my question is, you know, who is really, do you feel like you really have oversight of DOE and their and what they're doing? I mean, how do we in the public trust that what's being done is actually honest and that we're getting the truth?
What I can tell you is we do what we think is diligent oversight. And the last example that I can give is the Department of Energy totally made a mess dealing with asbestos during the Recovery Act. And again, we caught it. And so, you know, ultimately, probably 90% of those types of things, the way we find out about it is by employees who come and talk to us. That's not to say things don't go on, but ultimately, the best eyes out there are the workforce, because they're the ones who are doing it day to day. And when there's issues, they will come to us.
I think that these delays are too long. And you really do need to request more funding for them. And as some people have pointed out, if you are delayed, it'll be more expensive to fix in the future and also more dangerous to fix. And I think that another area that you need to really be concerned about is the unlined trenches, which have all kinds of stuff in there, which is not even, nobody really knows for sure. And this this whole exercise up there at Hanford is, it seems to me, it's kind of a giant shell game where it's just sort of reconfiguring things around. It's sort of become apparent to me from past experience and also just listening tonight, this milestone system just doesn't really work. It's always changing. And, you know, deadlines that are not deadlines are not serious, ineffective, and they're just kind of meaningless. I mean, I'm not trying to imply that, you know, any of you are not, you know, doing your job or conscientious or something, but I think over the years, a lot of the contractors haven't been, and a lot of them have been no good, you know, that it's been proven. And so I guess the final thing I wanted to reiterate what some people had said, that I really would like to have more meetings in Portland, because a lot of times there's meetings in Richland or Seattle or something, but then Portland kind of gets left off the map there somehow. So I really would like, you know, if you're going to have them in the other places, have them in Portland too, I guess is what I want to say.
Hi, I'm Rachel from Heart of America Northwest, speaking on their behalf. Basically, just going to keep it really brief. I'm going to first echo what Liz Mattson from Hanford Challenge said last night in Seattle. Basically, we just believe that there really should be a deadline set in place for M16, even if it's just a shot in the dark. It's impossible to enforce a deadline that doesn't exist, and it's impossible to enforce funding for cleanup that doesn't have an enforceable deadline. Secondly, rather than prioritizing the different areas of the Central Plateau, I think it's really important that the money at Hanford is just really reevaluated. Contractors keep getting paid, but the work isn't being done and it continues to be delayed. And finally, we just ask again that the public involvement plan is respected. For anyone that's not aware, that requires that the agencies give public interest groups like Heart of America at least 30 to 45 days notice before a public comment period or public meetings like these. For this one in particular, the materials came out October 26th, and then the first meeting was 9 days later. For these, we had 3 weeks notice, and so our group wasn't able to put out a mailer, which excludes a whole group of the public that aren't able to be here now because they weren't aware that these meetings were happening. So it's just really important that we are given proper notice so that we can inform the public and then they can be here and voice, you know, opinions that are educated. So, thank you.
That was testimony from last night's hearing on the increased delays of the cleanup of the Hanford nuclear site in Washington. More information on the delays and how people are organizing around the issue can be found at the website columbiariverkeeper.org.
And now, we hear the latest news in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The NLRB has ordered a union election for skilled trades workers at VW's Chattanooga, Tennessee plant. The UAW skilled trades workers had petitioned for the election. UAW Secretary Treasurer Gary Castile commenting on opposition from VW for having just a skilled trades vote on union representation, says that, quote, "It's unfortunate that in the middle of Volkswagen's widening emissions scandal, we had to spend weeks debating workers' rights that clearly are protected under federal law. Volkswagen's attempt to sidestep U.S. law was a waste of employees' time and energy," Castile says, "and a waste of government resources." UAW Local 42 is formed at the plant, but no collective bargaining agreement is in place. UAW Local 42 President Mike Cantrell says having skilled trades members decide whether they want union representation has always been one of the possible tactics for the union.
It's always been an option. It's always been part of our strategy that would happen possibly at some certain time. And with things progressing as we go, it is time for us to, we felt like it was the right time. We've had a lot of outside interference before. Hopefully we won't have it now. Hopefully we can let the people there in the plant that work there every day decide this election this time.
Local 42 says it's pleased that the NLRB upheld its members' rights by ordering the election. Local 42 is asking the company to respect the decision and not attempt to further interfere with the election. In another development, the UAW and the German union IG Metall are holding a press conference Thursday in Spring Hill, Tennessee, to announce a partnership that they say will explore new models of employee representation in the U.S. The Bernie Sanders presidential campaign says major news organization polling is showing that Sanders is much more popular with independents than Hillary Clinton. The Sanders campaign says in Wall Street Journal NBC polls and in a McClatchy Marist poll, Sanders outpolled Donald Trump by 9 points, 50-41%, and the Vermont senator beat Senator Marco Rubio of Florida by 5 points, 46-41. The campaign says Sanders outpolled Donald Trump, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, Senator Ted Cruz, and Carly Fiorina, and also did better than Clinton versus Bush and Cruz. Clinton still holds a substantial lead over Sanders nationally in the Democratic presidential primary.
Let's get America working. We must build, maintain, and repair our nation's crumbling infrastructure. Teamsters support a bipartisan approach to creating good jobs for American workers. Learn more at letsgetamericaworking.com. Teamsters strong, America stronger.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Food and Drug Administration on Thursday approved genetically modified salmon, the first such altered animal for human consumption in the United States. The Obama administration has stalled in approving the fast-growing salmon for more than 5 years amid consumer concerns about eating genetically modified foods. But the agency has said that the fish is safe to eat. By altering genetic materials, scientists have proposed, and in some cases actually created, animals bred to be disease-free, cleaner in their environments, or grow more efficiently. Opponents of the technology have taken advantage of increasing consumer concern about genetically modified organisms and have urged several retailers not to sell it. Some retailers have pledged to not sell the salmon, which has an added gene from the Pacific Chinook salmon that enables the fish to produce more growth hormone and grow faster. There is no evidence that the foods would be unsafe, but for some, it's an ethical issue. The FDA said in 2010 that the modified salmon appears to be safe to eat, and in 2012 that the salmon was unlikely to harm the environment.
A massive glacier in northeast Greenland has dramatically melted in the past decade and could raise global sea levels by as much as a foot and a half if it thawed completely. This is according to a study published Thursday. This glacier holds enough water to raise global sea levels by more than 18 inches if it were to melt away into nothing, but no timetable exists on how long that process could take, according to the study which was published in the peer-reviewed journal Science. The melting of this Zakariae-Istrom glacier is a result of rising temperatures in both the ocean and in the air. This was according to a study, the study co-author, Eric Rigneau of the University of California at Irvine. Even as warm air melts the top, currents carrying warm water melt the bottom, and then the glacier begins to crack apart. This Istrom glacier is near another large glacier, which is also melting away at a slower rate, and the two ice chunks make up 12% of the Greenland ice sheet. They could raise global sea levels by more than 39 inches if they both totally collapse. This process would very likely take several centuries. The planet's two major ice sheets are in Greenland and in Antarctica, and together they make up 99% of the freshwater ice here on the Earth, according to the National Snow and Ice Data Center. In Greenland, ice sheet decline continues to outpace accumulation because warmer temperatures have led to increased melt and faster glacier movement at the island's edges.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imamc.org for Thursday, November 19th, 2015. Two Palestinians killed by Israeli army gunfire in separate incidents. Meanwhile, six Palestinians were injured during drone invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Palestinian Ministry of Health announced on Thursday that Israeli soldiers shot and killed a 26-year-old Shadi Arafah from Hebron City in southern West Bank. On Thursday evening, a Palestinian armed man opened fire at a group of settlers, then rammed his car in another group near the Gosh Etzion illegal Israeli settlement block in southern West Bank. Israeli soldiers opened fire at the Palestinian attacker, killing Arafah as he was passing from the area to his home during the time of the attack. Two settlers were killed, another nine were injured during the Palestinian attack, Israeli media sources reported. Earlier on Thursday, 22-year-old Mohammed Alayan from Ramallah City died of wounds he sustained after being shot by Israeli soldiers during a protest at a military checkpoint outside Ramallah City. With the two deaths today, 91 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli army fire since October 1st, including 18 children. According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, 10,000 Palestinians have been injured in the same period. In other news, Israeli soldiers invaded on Thursday at dawn the Dehesh refugee camp south of Bethlehem, kidnapped at least two young Palestinians.